Hello, and welcome back to Off the Deaton Path. I'm Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society, and we welcome you to this podcast for October 1st, 2020. This is a new season of podcast, our fourth, and a lot has happened since we were together last winter. For those of you who have been watching our videos, Dispatches from Off the Deaton Path, we deeply appreciate your support and all your feedback, and lucky you, now you'll be relieved from having to actually see my face at least every other week. We are broadcasting this week from the Smoke 'em If You Got 'em division here at the Georgia Historical Society. This week's guest on the podcast is Sarah Mylove of the University of Virginia, author of the book The Cigarette, A Political History, published by Harvard University Press. But before we get to the interview, let's begin with a quick look at the ever-popular This Week in History. On October 1st, 1924, 96 years ago, the 39th President of the United States, Jimmy Carter, was born in Plains, Georgia. Carter graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis in 1946, served 7 years in the U.S. Navy, then returned to Georgia and served in the Georgia State Legislature, then as Governor of Georgia, President of the United States, diplomat, humanitarian, and finally Nobel Peace Prize winner. Happy 96th birthday, Mr. President. On October 2nd, 1950, 70 years ago, the Peanuts comic strip debuted in 7 newspapers and ran for almost 50 years. Creator Charles Schulz drew 17,897 strips in all, and by the time of his death, Peanuts ran in 2,600 newspapers with a readership of 355 million in 75 countries around the world. The characters, as you probably know, remain instantly recognizable today. Charles Schulz died on February 12, 2000 at the age of 77 and is buried in Pleasant Hills Cemetery in Sebastopol, California. On October 4th, 1970, 50 years ago, singer Janis Joplin died of a heroin overdose in Los Angeles at age 27. In the summer of 1966, Joplin was a drifter. 4 years later, she was a rock and roll legend. She'd gone from complete unknown to generational icon on the strength of a single blistering performance at the Monterey International Pop Festival in the summer of 1967. And she'd followed that up with 3 years of touring and recording that cemented her status with great songs like Piece of My Heart, Mercedes-Benz, and her biggest hit, Me and Bobby McGee. She epitomized the cliche of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, living fast and dying young. Janis Joplin was cremated, and her ashes were scattered from a plane into the Pacific Ocean and along Stinson Beach, California. On October 5th, 1739, 281 years ago, Tomachichi, the chief of the Yamacraw tribe who befriended General James Oglethorpe and the first Georgia colonist, died here in Savannah. Tomachichi created the Yamacraw from a group of Creek and Yamasee natives. They settled on the bluff overlooking the Savannah River where Tomachichi's ancestors were buried. During Georgia's first 5 years, Tomachichi set up trade and diplomatic connections between the English and the Creeks, and he traveled with Oglethorpe to England to lobby in person for fair trade and the rights of his people. Tomachichi died in his late 90s, and according to legend, was buried beneath a pyramid of stones in what became Wright Square in Savannah. On October 6, 1917, 103 years ago, civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer was born in Ruleville, Mississippi. She was the youngest of 20 children born to sharecroppers, the granddaughter of enslaved Africans, and she received only a sixth-grade education. Her civil rights activism began in August 1962 when she was 44 years of age when she answered a call by the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, for volunteers to challenge voter registration procedures that excluded African Americans. She attempted to register to vote, failed a literacy test, and was fired from her job for even attempting to register. She finally became a registered voter in 1963. In 1964, Hamer co-founded and became vice chairperson of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, established after unsuccessful attempts by African Americans to work with the all-white, pro-segregation Mississippi Democratic Party. That year, she testified before the Credentials Committee of the Democratic National Convention, and she famously said, "I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired." This courageous foot soldier of democracy died on March 14, 1977 at age 59 and is buried in the Fannie Lou Hamer Memorial Garden in Ruleville, Mississippi. Finally, on October 7, 1780, 240 years ago, the American militia under William Campbell defeated a band of American loyalists under Major Patrick Ferguson at the Battle of Kings Mountain during the American Revolution. The battle took place 9 miles south of the present-day town of Kings Mountain, North Carolina, in what is now rural Cherokee County, South Carolina. The battle has been described as the war's largest all-American fight. Major Ferguson's Tory force, made up mostly of American loyalists from South Carolina and elsewhere, was the western wing of General Lord Cornwallis's North Carolina invasion force. 1,000 American frontiersmen under Colonel Campbell of Virginia gathered in the backcountry on the border of the two states to resist Ferguson's advance. The battle started at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon on October 7th and lasted a little over an hour. When it was over, the Loyalists had suffered 157 killed, 163 wounded, and almost 700 captured. Out of almost 1,000 men, the Patriot militia suffered just 28 killed and 60 wounded. It was a major turning point in the Southern campaign of the American Revolution. In 1931, Congress created the Kings Mountain National Military Park at the site of the battle. Now, you may have noticed that I skipped October 3rd, and that's because I was saving it for last for a very personal reason. On October 3rd, 1932, 88 years ago, my father, Billy Russell Deaton, was born in Winder, Georgia, the fifth of nine children born to my grandparents, Hubert and Reba Deaton. They were sharecroppers. As brother, husband, father, grandfather, and friend, he is respected and loved by all who know him. Any success I've achieved in my life has been because I have stood on his shoulders. Happy 88th birthday, Dad. And that's This Week in History. And now for this week's edition of Obituaries You Were Too Busy to Notice. Now, this one goes all the way back to January, back when the year 2020 still held out so much promise and before all the crazy started. But I had to include this because it has to do with the Andy Griffith Show, and you know that I'm always a big fan of that show. Now, even if, like me, you're a fan of that show, chances are you missed the passing of actor Jack Burns at age 86 on January 27th in Toluca Lake, California. If you're a fan of the show, you know that Don Knotts starred as Deputy Barney Fife in the first 5 seasons of the show, all the black and white episodes, and that he left before the 6th season. Jack Burns was the actor tapped to replace Knotts, and he played Deputy Warren Ferguson for 11 episodes in the 1965-66 season. Now, to put it mildly, it didn't work. Burns was let go after 11 episodes, and the character was never even mentioned again. And here's the thing, Jack Burns could actually be featured in a segment of our show periodically that we call People You Thought Were Dead But Are Still Living. I confess I did not know Jack Burns was still alive until January. So how many of the cast members of the Andy Griffith Show are still living? Well, by my count, first of all, Ron Howard obviously was the youngest cast member, and he's now 66. Eleanor Donahue, who played Ellie in season 1, is 83, still living. Maggie Peterson Mancuso, who played Charlene Darling, is 79. Rodney Dillard, who played her brother, one of the Darling boys, is 78, still living. And Betty Lynn, who played Thelma Lou, is still living, just celebrated a birthday recently, and is 94 years old. Now, there are various guest stars through the years who, of course, are still living. Barbara Eden, who famously guest starred in an episode early on, is still living. But that, to my knowledge, of the regulars anyway, are all that are left. If you know differently, if there's somebody I missed, please drop me a line and let me know. And finally, in the people you thought were dead but are still living, imagine my surprise to find out this week, and this is on me, that legendary Los Angeles Dodgers manager Tommy Lasorda, still living and turned 93 this week. I had no idea he was still alive. So happy birthday, Tommy Lasorda. And now to our interview this week. My special guest is Sarah Mylove, author of the new book, The Cigarette, A Political History, published in 2019 by Harvard University Press. She received her PhD and master's from Princeton University and her BA from Harvard, and she now teaches history at the University of Virginia. She was here to talk about her book, The Cigarette, A Political History. Here's Sarah Mylove. Sarah Mylove, welcome to the podcast.
It is such a delight to be here. Thank you.
You are an assistant professor of history at the University of Virginia.
Yes,
and you
I
teach
am.
A wide variety of courses that go beyond just American history. I noticed that you teach eugenics, among other things. What are some other courses that you teach there?
So, yes, this semester I'm teaching a course on eugenics. I've taught courses on disaster. I've taught courses on debates over science in 20th century America. I focus on U.S. history and political history and social history mainly.
So we're talking about your book today, The Cigarette, A Political History, which is obviously a topic of wide-ranging interest and very timely, given the controversy, the current controversy over e-cigarettes, vaping, whatever these things are called. And I know you've written on that a little bit. So I just want to dive right in here. First of all, how did you get interested in this topic?
So when somebody is in grad school, they're casting about for novelty. And when I was in grad school in the early 2010s, 2010s, whatever we're deciding to call that decade, there was a big debate happening within the subfield of Southern history. Is the South, does it make sense to speak of the South as a distinct region? And some historians were saying, well, actually, if you look at the vibrancy of political life, you find vibrancy in suburbs, and those suburbs can be outside of Atlanta, those suburbs can be outside of Phoenix, those suburbs can be in Southern California. So we should be thinking more about the Sun Belt as a more meaningful region than the states of the former Confederacy, per se. And so I, growing up in Florida and having traveled extensively throughout the South, I was struck in just a kind of voyeuristic, touristic way about the persistence of agriculture and that kind of persistence of the land kind of fed into a Southern mythology. And so I was interested in pursuing an agricultural history, surprisingly. And I thought, you know, I'm a 20th century historian, a really powerful product coming out of the South in the 20th century is tobacco. And so I kind of went from there thinking about tobacco, not through the lens of big tobacco, but thinking about it as a crop.
And you really do write about tobacco. I mean, it's called The Cigarette. Your book is called The Cigarette, and that's generally what we think of when we think of tobacco. We think of cigarettes. We think of lung cancer. One of the things I was struck by in your book is that you really do write about tobacco as if it's something that farmers grow. It, in and of itself, does not seem to be an evil thing the way we think about it today. And I was struck by the fact that in your book, this is not a history of big tobacco. This is not a book about villains and good guys, although there are certainly villains and good guys in this book. But we were talking beforehand about the fact that it seems to me you try very hard not to make this a book of people in black hats and people in white hats.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm really delighted that you noticed that. So, you know, the story of tobacco in the 20th century is, on the one hand, undoubtedly a story about corporate villainy, and other scholars have written about that very powerfully. What motivated me, and this kind of goes back to the deep history of this book, was looking at this, at tobacco as a crop, and asking how was it that for 50 years after the Surgeon General declared in 1964 that cigarette smoking may be hazardous to your health, how did it come that for 50 years after that, the federal government continued to subsidize tobacco farmers? Like, where does the power of this constituency lie? And the answer to that I outline in the first half of the book. I make the case that tobacco farmers were a really powerful constituency, in part because there were quite a number of them at a critical moment in time. And that moment in time was the 1930s during the New Deal, when it was really important for the government to shore up the income of all farmers. And tobacco farmers in particular, because they grew a commodity in the South, kind of had an outsized importance in Congress because of the centrality of Southern Democrats to Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal coalition. So this moment in time kind of becomes inscribed in history because this program lasts the rest of the 20th century. So in a way, I'm not excusing by any means the tobacco industry and the decades-long program of deception that they engaged in. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying that to really understand the staying power of tobacco, you also have to look at what the regulations the federal government put in place to help the crop flourish.
So this is a two-part book, and correct me at any point along here when I'm wrong about this, but the first part is really about how tobacco became big tobacco, how this interplay of government and corporations and farmers made American tobacco a worldwide phenomenon.
Yes,
that gives us sort of, and you even just talk about this, and I'm going to read a quote in a minute about. Looking back, the idea of the madman, right? When you watch Mad Men, cigarettes are ubiquitous. They are everywhere. They're just a part of the culture. It is not, for most of the 20th century, as it would become, a class, an action that is almost something that you think of now in terms
of...
A lower class phenomenon. And, but at the same... And then the second half of the book is about how people, really at the grassroots level... came at this monolith of government and big corporations and began to take on smoking, public smoking, in smaller places because the government was not going to do this in spite of the Surgeon General's report, which you begin the book with in January of 1964. On a Saturday, the Surgeon General calls a press conference and announces the findings of this commission that had been charged, I guess, with investigating the possible health dangers of tobacco. Start with that, if you will, and just very, very briefly tell the story of that Saturday morning press conference and why was it on Saturday?
Yeah, we don't usually think of big government announcements on weekends, right? You know, if you want press attention, you should do it on a Monday or Tuesday when all the journalists are fresh and ready to write about things. But the Surgeon General understood. His name was Luther Terry. He had originally been appointed by John F. Kennedy, but of course, Kennedy is assassinated. He becomes the Surgeon General under LBJ. Luther Terry knows that this document is going to be a real blockbuster. And he also knows that that tobacco is economically important industry in the U.S. And so the press conference is held on a Saturday so as to give the stock market a chance to recover.
Wow.
Yeah, but I think even in that detail, you see the idea that the government is dancing around the industry. You see in that detail the sense that, you know, we're going to say something on behalf of consumers of tobacco and on behalf of a broader sense of the American public. But it's still important for the federal government to keep private interests at the forefront of the minds of policymakers. And so they decide, you know, out of deference to the industry, in a sense, to hold the press conference on a Saturday.
One of the things I didn't know, and there's a lot of things in this book that I did not know, the level of research that you did is extremely impressive.
Thank you.
But I did not know, really, that World War I was a turning point in the history of the cigarette. At the beginning of the 20th century, most people consumed tobacco in another form besides the cigarette. Is that correct?
Yeah, it actually took until about the 1930s for cigarettes to be the primary way that Americans consumed tobacco. Earlier in the century, Americans were much more likely to put tobacco in a pipe or to chew tobacco. In the early part of the 20th century, cigarettes, especially mechanically made cigarettes, you know, sold, bought, you know, in a pack of cigarettes, were considered, you know, essentially the vice of immigrants. You know, this was also a time of prolific immigration to the United States. They were considered something that immigrant delinquent boys did in cities where there were too many immigrants. And so, and this is in the from the perspective of people who wanted to see less tobacco being consumed. So in the early 20th century, along with temperance for alcohol, you also see a temperance against tobacco consumption in many of the same states.
In fact, there were states that actually passed laws banning cigarette smoking in public, or was it just banning them altogether?
Banning the sale of cigarettes in the early 20th century. Kansas, in fact, did not repeal its law, its tobacco prohibition, until 1927. So it took, even though in I think the minds of modern Americans, we think, oh, in the past, everybody smoked. The actual period of time during which smoking was a commonly observed and commonly practiced habit was really maximum 4 decades, and really intensively within that 2 decades, the 1950s and the 1960s.
And you write that World War I was the turning point for the cigarette, both in terms of its marketing, both in terms of its popularity, and the fact that it caught on with not just the American public, but really a worldwide phenomenon. What happened in World War I? How did that happen?
Well, as I mentioned before, you know, in the early 20th century, cigarettes were seen as, you know, a vice, and a non-American vice at that. But during the war, there is really an about-face taken by military brass that say, you know, if you're thinking about vices that young men can get up to on the war front, there are a lot worse things than cigarettes, if you know what I mean. And so you can track this change in attitude on the part of the YMCA, for example. Prior to the war, the YMCA had really been on the anti-tobacco train. During the war, the YMCA and the Red Cross hand out cigarettes in canteens in Europe. So you actually can see changes within important, you know, civic associations that showed the increasing acceptability of the cigarette.
And it really became a marketing phenomenon too, right, in terms of these
yes,
Mad Men type agencies that really began to market the cigarette.
Yeah, so during the 1920s, generally in American culture, you see a tremendous boom in the field of advertising and public relations. You see this in, it's not just the tobacco that is a beneficiary of this. Many other industries begin to be intensively advertised. It's kind of the first boom of consumer culture in the 20th century. So there's more advertisements for cars. There's advertisements for things people didn't even know they needed to be sold, like deodorant and Listerine, inventions of new problems to be satisfied by business. But really in tobacco, you see the simultaneous growing up of the tobacco industry and the advertising industry, and really deep ties between tobacco executives and executives that would become famous within advertising.
And one of the ways, it seems to me, that cigarettes became part of mainstream American culture was through motion pictures. Mm. I remember the very first time that I ever saw Casablanca, I was struck by how many cigarettes Humphrey Bogart smokes in that movie. And the second time I watched it, or the third, I actually counted. And you actually, there's a quote from your book, and I want to read. And so it becomes not only mainstream, but it becomes part of the ethos of both the American male on screen, mm-hmm. but just sort of Americans in general from the 30s and 40s, when you see them on screen, they're almost always smoking. And I want to read a quote here. You say, "Tobacco forces us to strip away sentimentalities about the 20th century. Nobody who understands the damage that cigarettes do to a body would wish to live in the smoky world of mid-century America."
It's interesting that you bring up Humphrey Bogart, and I think he's a perfect example of this. So, you know, during the 30s and 40s, Hollywood studios operated under what was called the studio system, where basically they owned the labor of the actors that worked for a particular studio. And that included assigning actors to advertise particular cigarette brands. So the fact that we have an outsized vision of tobacco has everything to do with the interlocking structures of production between a very organized, almost cartelized Hollywood system and a very organized, cartelized tobacco industry. Now, Humphrey Bogart is a really sad case in particular. He was, you know, known, of course, to be a tremendous tobacco smoker, and he died weighing under 100 pounds, not wanting to see any of his friends due to tobacco-related disease.
Yeah, and died at, I think, 57
yeah,
years old.
Yeah, tragically
very,
early.
Very young,
yeah.
From lung cancer.
Yep, absolutely.
To go back just a moment, one of the other things I was struck by is that tobacco production early in the 20th century was centered in New York. You mentioned how tied it was to immigration mm-hmm. and immigrants. We, of course, now think about North Carolina, Duke. Mm-hmm. And that name, of course, is a prominent role. So how did that shift from, and we had always associated, I guess, tobacco with Virginia as part mm-hmm. of colonial Virginia mm-hmm. as the, you know, the crop. But how does this shift happen from New York to North Carolina?
So tobacco, the crop, had been localized. Well, at first, a particular kind of tobacco called flue-cured tobacco, which actually refers to an on-farm process of flue-curing, which is putting dried leaves in a barn and applying ever higher degrees of temperature to the leaves until they turn lemony yellow color. Flue-curing really took hold in the 19th century, and it starts in Virginia, but then it spreads very quickly to North Carolina, and North Carolina becomes the most significant flue-curing state. But flue-cured tobacco is also grown in South Carolina, Georgia, and parts of northern Florida. But what's interesting about considering cigarettes as a southern product is that does not happen right away or very quickly. So in the late 19th century, Duke, who is kind of the Rockefeller of cigarettes, a robber baron, does everything he can to buy up smaller cigarette companies and consolidate them under his American Tobacco Company, which was known colloquially as the Tobacco Trust. His goal at first is just to get labor as cheap as possible. And so he is in search of a predictable source of labor to produce cigarettes. And, you know, it seems as though machines might be the solution to this. There's a very famous machine called the Bonzac machine. It's one of the earliest mechanical cigarette machines. But it turned out that at first, these Bonzac machines were shaky. They didn't really work as well as actual human beings. So Duke gets, he recruits basically Jewish immigrants who had been the top cigarette rollers in New York City. He recruits them down to Durham. There was a small Jewish quarter in the late 19th century in Durham where these people lived. And he ultimately decides to fire them when they are too persistent in trying to form a union. And from there on, he only wants to recruit native-born child labor until, of course, the mechanical cigarette rolling machine can be perfected and people are replaced altogether.
So that's when really the center of what we think of as big tobacco relocates to North Carolina, yes. Where it essentially remains, right?
Yeah. So, of course, we can't forget the power of Philip Morris, now rebranded as Altria, which is in my state of Virginia.
Yeah. And we were talking about James Buchanan Duke, mm-hmm. I guess, and his maybe, I think his father was Washington Duke, who sort of mm-hmm. started the whole thing. I'm going to ask you to play counterfactual history for a moment. World War One. We always talk about World War One caused World War Two. Without the first, there wouldn't have been a second. There might not have been a Hitler. There wouldn't have been a Nazi mm-hmm. Germany. There wouldn't have been, and so on and so on and so on. So is it fair to say, or even think about, I was struck by this, if there's no World War One, does the 20th century with cigarettes look like it does, or would that have happened anyway?
I don't mean
to put you on the spot, but I'm just curious what you think.
Yeah, you know, historians hate counterfactuals because all these million contingencies kind of get in our way of thinking through it. I think that, so flue curing is a really interesting phenomenon. Just to go back to the on-farm process, when you make tobacco smoke easier to inhale, which is part of what flue curing does, you also make it more addictive. Mm. And so I think that it is, I believe that the rest of the century would have played out with addiction, though perhaps it would have taken 10 years later to manifest itself, at the very latest by World War II. The tobacco industry was already powerful. James Duke already had the Tobacco Trust several decades before people were smoking manufactured cigarettes. People would have become addicted to tobacco smoke because it's an addictive substance and a wealthy industry was pushing it.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned earlier, your research and your knowledge of the tobacco industry and how tobacco is produced and the intricacies of federal regulations and federal policy. It's amazing. Talk a little bit about how you had to immerse, because you must have, unless you just, I don't know if you grew up on a tobacco farm.
But I did not, no.
You really, I mean, tell me, you must have immersed yourself in some very particular sources in order to understand how all of this really takes place, because your knowledge is not superficial here. It's pretty deep.
So to cast my mind back to 2010, when I spent a total of 9 months in archives in North Carolina. Some at Duke University, many at UNC, which has a phenomenal collection of papers of Southern politicians, and I was very interested in politicians that represented tobacco-growing regions. I spent a lot of time at North Carolina State, which is the agriculture college in North Carolina, where there is still a Philip Morris chair of agricultural science. So, you know, tobacco was central to the building up of that institution. I also spent time in some kind of strange places. There's a historic house in Durham called the Duke Homestead Museum, and I had actually contacted when I went to do this time in the archives in North Carolina. I had contacted a man who I knew to be important in tobacco politics, kind of farmer politics. Not, he was not an elected politician, but I knew that he was kind of a player in the mix of North Carolina agribusiness in the 70s and 80s, which meant I thought, okay, he'll probably still be alive. And so we met off a highway outside of Cary, North Carolina, in a McDonald's. And he basically suggested a number of places I wouldn't have thought to look for organizations that I did not know existed. This was just at the beginning of my research. And one place he told me to look was at the Duke Homestead Museum, which is really a museum to farm life. And there's an animatronic farmer in there. The gift shop has, you know, things for kids and field trip groups. And it honestly has not been updated in quite a while. But the people who worked there were wonderful, absolutely accommodating. And I asked, I said, you know, the gentleman's name has suggested that I look at these papers that are housed there. The papers are of the Tobacco Growers Information Committee. He was a part of this organization. They said, oh, yeah, come on back. We have these file cabinets. They're not organized, but you're welcome to spend as much time as you want in there. And what the Tobacco Growers Information Committee was, it was essentially the growers' wing of big tobacco. So in the 1950s, all the tobacco execs get together literally in a smoke-filled room in the Plaza Hotel in New York, and they launch what ends up being a multi-decade, half-century conspiracy to deceive the public. And as part of this conspiracy, they are trying to organize offshoots, institutions that can help their constituents, so the different parts of the industry all get on the same page. And so this one was for farmers, and so it was to disseminate essentially pro-tobacco information among farmers, to let tobacco farmers know if the federal government is thinking of hiking taxes or the federal government is trying to shove prohibition down your throat. So it's really kind of a lobby group for farmers and to get farmers angry. And so these papers, you know, to my knowledge, had never really been written about. And I think that's because they'd never been seen before, because they were in the, you know, the file cabinets of this museum. So I go there and it's absolutely fascinating. And there's actually a Pop-Tart in one of the file cabinets, just one free-floating Pop-Tart, which I still think about that. Like, why was there just one in there? Why didn't it have the foil paper? But, you know, it just, I'd say if I was giving any advice to graduate students who are researching 20th century history, it's to find a minor character that's still alive and you strongly sense wants to talk, and make contact with them, because you're not going to replicate what they say, but they will turn you on to a world that you had no idea about.
Did you have any access to or need any access to any corporate archives?
This is what is so fascinating about working with tobacco. As a result of the litigation that began in the 1990s, as part of the resolution to that litigation, the tobacco industry is required to make public on an internet archive any documents produced through the legal process of discovery. So there's over 20 million documents that are unparalleled for getting a view inside the corporate like machinery of the tobacco industry in a way that Americans just don't have access to. And I frankly don't think anybody in the world has access to looking inside the guts of an industry the way we can see inside the tobacco industry because of this online archive. So that was tremendously useful and has been useful to tobacco researchers, not just historians, but people in public health as well.
So you didn't have to go knocking on the doors of Philip Morris and ask to see their file cabinet, so to speak.
No.
Information was there.
That information is out there, you know, to the chagrin of Philip Morris. But, mm-hmm. you know, what's interesting, too, is this information can be used in any number of ways. But because part of the strategy of tobacco lawyers when they were engaging in litigation against trial attorneys in the 80s and 90s, part of their strategy was snowing under the attorneys, just giving them like massive dumps of documents that they hoped the attorneys wouldn't have time to go through. Well, that ended up, in a sense, rebounding back on them once all of this information had to become public. But there is a lot of stuff also about the agricultural side of tobacco you know, probably was less used by researchers than things more directly related to medicine and health.
So the Surgeon General's report comes out in 1964. It states what, as you mentioned, everyone had sort of known privately for years, whether they were wanting to admit it publicly or not. But here was a government agency saying that cigarettes are deadly, dangerous, and addictive and bad for your health, or could be, I guess. And so from that moment on, there's a movement, either mm-hmm. for or against, in order to do something to mm-hmm. carry that out, mm-hmm. whether it is to get Americans to smoke less, to understand the dangers. And so I want you to talk a little bit about some of the grassroots efforts.
Yeah.
I can tell you that when I was in high school, in the late 70s and early 80s, there was still a smoking section for students.
That's referenced in the book, some high schools even, you know, essentially encouraged it by saying, here, you can go smoke here.
Yes. And you had to have a note from your parents. And it was they were all out in this little place with the, you know, with a fence around it. But you can't imagine that happening now, that school. And yet, I think it says something about the power of tobacco and smoking. And still, there's this movement afoot now. Smoking is so stigmatized.
Mm-hmm.
You don't smoke in restaurants. You don't smoke on airplanes. You don't smoke in hospitals. You don't smoke in public buildings. And as we mentioned, it has become something of a, if you ask people, you reference this, if you do surveys, people think of smoking as being something that lower class people do. How did all of that happen? That's a big question.
It's a big question.
It's a big question, but that is the heart of your book.
Yeah.
Grassroots activism taking on a very powerful opponent.
Yeah. If I had to say in broad brushstrokes what the book shows, it's that for much of the 20th century, the government was organized to respond to organized producers. And one of those groups is the tobacco industry. And within the industry, there are organized tobacco farmers. But beginning in the late 60s, but really accelerating during the 1970s, tobacco can be seen as part of a broader movement to make the government in general more open to everyday Americans, more open to a broader sense of the public. And different, I mean, I sometimes think of this metaphorically that activists of all stripes, from civil rights activists to environmental activists to consumer protection activists, they have to invent new on-ramps for everyday Americans to try to get the government to do what they want. And so anti-tobacco activists are very much part of this social movement to rethink who government is for, essentially. It's not, government isn't just for organized producers. Government is for the public, and therefore it has to respond to us. And so, you know, one thing that was really surprising to me in my research was kind of the really homespun nature of early anti-tobacco activism. And so, you know, I think we have in our minds the idea that, all right, in the 1960s, the government says smoking causes cancer. By 1965, they slap a warning label on the side of a pack of cigarettes. But, you know, actually, cigarette consumption doesn't change that much in the first couple of years after the Surgeon General's warning comes out. And in fact, the industry was pretty happy to have that warning label on the side of the cigarette pack because it affirmed what you can think of as an assumption of risk paradigm, that the smoker of a cigarette has been warned, and so he or she can decide what to do. And if they get sued, this warning label will come back to be a very useful shield for the industry. But what anti-tobacco activists figure out in the early 1970s is that all of that doesn't matter if you can show essentially the secondhand harm of cigarettes, if you can show that your smoking violates my rights. And so in the early 1970s, a woman named Clara Gowan basically decides that she's had enough of bending her life around smoking. She's, in her words, a housewife. She's got two young daughters, and one of her daughters has a very crippling tobacco allergy, which means they really can't go out to dinner. Which, if you're a middle-class American person, that's a significant restriction on your quality of life if you have to feel like you're shut in all the time, and if you're a mom that you have to do all those dishes. So she and her girlfriends decide they're going to engage in their first political action. They're going to remove the ashtrays from their own homes. Of course, they don't smoke, their husbands don't smoke, but the ashtrays were in their homes for the comfort of their guests. And I was just very struck by this narration that this small action, what could be smaller than removing an ashtray from your own house to say, my house, my rules, that this action required solidarity. It required a plan ahead of time. It required your friends to tell you that it's okay, you're doing the right thing. The fact that this required all of that activity just suggested to me how oppressed these people must have felt. Like, you know, it's not the kind of oppression of Jim Crow, obviously, but it's a kind of fear of breaking a social norm. And so Gowan begins this first action, and from there she starts a group called GASP, Group Against Smoke and Pollution. And she uses the mimeograph machine of her local lung association, which mails out a newsletter announcing the formation of GASP to hundreds of affiliates all over the country. And within a year, 500 new chapters of GASP are born throughout the United States. And what these GASP chapters do is they serve as social solidarity for people who know that by asking other people to smoke, they're going to make some people angry. They serve as a signal to business that there are non-smokers who are making themselves visible, and hey, we'd like a smoke-free night on Tuesdays, you know, that business should accommodate them. But they also end up honing a vocabulary of rights, that non-smokers also have rights in public, and actually, non-smokers are the majority. And so their desires in public should be deferred to and should reign supreme rather than those of smokers. And so if you go back to that metaphor of the on-ramp, what these activists do is they don't go for the federal government. That's out of reach for them to try to pass a non-smokers' rights bill, though they try and they fail repeatedly. But what is available to them are city councils, which begin to pass some of the first non-smokers' rights legislation by the middle of the 1970s. Hundreds of city councils across the country by 1977 have passed the first anti-smoking ordinances.
And do the tobacco companies, does this take them by surprise and they go, oh, wait a minute, we were so focused on the feds, we forgot about this. Now, what do we need to do here?
Yeah, that is what happens. So, you know, the power of the tobacco industry was lodged in Washington, and it's much easier to keep track of things that are happening at the central government level than it is to pay attention to what's happening out in thousands of localities across the country. I mean, for the tobacco industry that sees these ordinances coming from every which way in the country, it's like playing whack-a-mole. So going back to those internal industry documents, you can see an increasing level of concern on the part of the Tobacco Institute, which is the lobbying arm of the tobacco companies, you know, saying, you know, the seas in Washington might look calm, but what is happening out in the states, you know, gives us cause for concern.
And were they ever successful in overturning any of these things?
Yeah, I mean, so the strategy becomes, by the 1980s, the strategy becomes to essentially preempt local legislation by passing laws at the state level that don't allow city governments to enact stronger non-smoking rights legislation. Now, obviously, they're not successful. Non-smoking becomes the norm in public places, but they do realize pretty quickly that they have to thwart some of this onslaught somehow. And, you know, by the 80s and certainly by the 1990s, they have stemmed the tide that really could have overwhelmed them in the 1970s.
I guess one of their big successes in the 90s was, I believe, the FDA at one point declared tobacco a drug and it was going to be regulated as a drug, and Big Tobacco took that on. This was at the same time, I think, as the Republican Revolution, Newt Gingrich's revolution in 94, and they were successful in stemming that and pushing back against that.
Yeah, so in Washington, Big Tobacco continues to be successful until really 2009 is the first time with the passage of an act in Congress. That's the first time the FDA regulates tobacco. Okay, so it had not been under the regulatory purview of the Food and Drug Administration until 2009. But something else happens in the 1990s, which is a testament to the local movement of non-smokers' rights. So it might surprise many listeners to know that OSHA does not regulate smoking at the workplace. And OSHA was going to regulate smoking at work in the 1990s. It was considering passing rules because EPA had labeled secondhand smoke, a significant human carcinogen. So OSHA had the science behind it to say, okay, we're gonna regulate now. Well, basically, the tobacco industry, you know, threatens to tie this all up in litigation, and the anti-tobacco forces say, okay, it's not really even worth it to have OSHA regulate this because the non-smokers' rights movement had been so successful at the local level. That's a more fruitful road to proceed down.
The idea you talk about, the idea of a non-smoker, is that's really something that comes out in the 60s and 70s, right? I mean, we think of it now as you say, non-smokers are the majority. But before, people did not, I guess, self-identify as non-smokers.
Right.
So that is a part of this whole grassroots thing as well. Even the nomenclature that we use comes out of this movement.
Yeah. So, you know, I actually think that non-smokers have been so internalized, you don't even have to declare it anymore, right? I mean, just the fact is most people don't smoke, and you don't even have to declare yourself a non-smoker anymore because most restaurants don't allow smoking. So you never even have to say, do I want a smoking or a non-smoking section, right? Like most hotels, many hotels don't offer the option of smoking in most rooms. You have to declare yourself a smoker rather than declare yourself a non-smoker. Mm-hmm. But in the late 1960s and early 1970s, there was not a vocabulary of non-smoker. That had to be declared by people who wanted to become visible to rulemaking bodies. And so that's where you really get the first vocabulary of non-smokers' rights. And in this rights vocabulary, these activists are essentially playing off the moral resonance of the civil rights movement, and at times making claims that, you know, by not being allowed to be comfortable in public, non-smokers are an oppressed group. But they're not just an oppressed minority, they're an oppressed majority. And so their rights need to be acknowledged ever more fully.
Let's come forward in time and talk to me a little bit about vaping, where we are now. Is that controlled by Big Tobacco? And whether it is or it isn't, what's the future there? What kind of battlegrounds are we going to see in this arena?
Yeah. So when you talk about vaping and e-cigarette use, you know, Juul controls most of that market. And when we talk about Juul, we are absolutely talking about big tobacco. Altria, which is the rebranding of Philip Morris, owns a 35% stake in the company. And just in the past 2 weeks, two Juul executives quit to be replaced by Altria executives. So the top leadership, including the CEO of Juul now, is, I mean, you should think of it as Philip Morris. So I think for people in public health, there are a few residences. I mean, for it's not even just a residence. There's repetitions, I'd say. First is that Juul has shown a facility in marketing to young people. It has also shown a willingness to stop marketing, but to young people, or at least, you know, it's claiming it's no longer going to market to young people. But in here, too, you hear echoes of the tobacco story. So in the late 1960s, tobacco was 7 out of the top 10 most aired advertisements on TV were for cigarettes. And anti-tobacco activist, a man by the name of John Banzaff, a lawyer, sees this and he says, well, this seems to me like if the tobacco industry is getting all of this airtime, then the fairness doctrine, which was a rule that said equal airtime had to be given to issues of public importance, it seems to me that the fairness doctrine ought to apply to tobacco as well, and public health should get equal airtime. And so he wins a ruling in front of the Federal Communications Commission, and by 1967, there are the first public health advertisements on the air talking about the fact that cigarettes will kill you. Now, these put a lot of heat on the tobacco industry, and the tobacco industry decides that it will itself go off of the air. And so they accede without a fight to a broadcast ban in 1970. And there's echoes of what's happening right now with Juul today, that, you know, they see that there is eyes on them, they see there's heat on them, they're going to accede to certain kinds of restrictions to prove themselves a responsible corporate citizen. But where do the profits go? Where did all of those, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars that the tobacco industry was spending on television? Well, they plowed them into billboard advertising, magazine advertising, and corporate sponsorship. So we'll have to see what happens when Juul decides it will retire some of its marketing techniques. I think on a deeper level, though, what's happening with Juul is the nightmare scenario for public health, which is their singular success for the past 50 years was making smoking socially unacceptable, was eradicating that culture of smoking. And right now there is forming a youth culture of vaping. And it is not socially unacceptable. It is, you know, highly socially desirable if you're a young person to be vaping. And so I think that that's very frightening to people in public health, the creation of a new culture that there's not yet a vocabulary or an on-ramp, or very many on-ramps that have been opened to stop it.
Out of the land of the tobacco plant come a tall, hard-riding, long, lean bloke, feared by his friends and enemies alike, called by the name of Johnny Smoke. Johnny Smoke. Johnny Smoke. Johnny Smoke. Where are you heading, Johnny Smoke? How many silos will be emptied tonight? How many men will lie still beneath the sky? How many tears will be shed because of you? How many more will die? Out of the land of the tobacco plant come a tall, fast-drawn, long, lean bloke, feared by his friends and enemies alike, feared by all who come to know the name of Johnny Smoke.
I have to ask you a question. You mentioned the anti-smoking ads. Real quick, did you in your research come across, or did you already know about the anti-smoking ads in the late 60s, early 70s, Johnny Smoke?
No.
You don't? You can look it up on YouTube, and I only bring this up because when I was probably in the late 60s, early 70s, when I was 7, 8 years old, these ads came on, and they were frightening. They were terrifying. The voiceover was James Earl Jones, and I didn't know that until much later, but they scared the crap out of all of us.
He will do that. Yes.
Yeah, and it's very...
Prior to Star Wars, or...
Prior. It's okay. Like 1970.
So maybe part of the Star Wars phenomenon should be viewed... Yeah. Through these anti-tobacco advertisements.
That's right, yeah.
He is
but
terrifying.
You'll have to look those up. And yeah. I was interested to see in the comments that everybody was scared by these things.
Yes.
That,
they not resonated.
So much as not so much because of the anti-tobacco, but they're just creepy. They're just really scary, and they aired late at night, and it was just... Anyway, I couldn't help but think about that as I was reading about John Banzoff. He's really an interesting character in here, and he has a lot to do with the success of the anti-smoking community.
Yeah, when he first writes this very novel, very creative letter to the FCC, he's only 27 years old. He's just a few years out of law school, and he is at a corporate law firm whose biggest client is Philip Morris. After the success of his petition, he realized maybe he needs another job, and he becomes a professor at GW Law School. And as a professor, a lot of the teaching that he does is centered around kind of consumer protection law, public interest law, and he kind of encourages this kind of advocacy among his students.
So my last question before we wrap up is, I know your book is just out. As we sit here in October of 2019, reviews are just coming out, but have you received any negative backlash, either from big tobacco or because of this world we live in that's so viral on Twitter or social media, of people who are just pushing back against whatever may be in this book? Because we're in a very anti-science climate right now where everything seems to be up for grabs. And so I'm just wondering if you've experienced any of this.
Yeah. So when I've written about vaping, I get a lot of Twitter backlash. And I don't, you know, I can't take that stuff too seriously because these are anonymous people on Twitter, and I actually just changed my notification settings so I see less of that stuff. But it also makes me wonder who is behind it. You know, part of one deep failing of big tobacco was mobilizing a pro-smoking constituency. So you see, you know, really deeply held anti-tobacco positions, but on the part of smokers, you do not see the same level of intensity saying, no, we deserve to smoke. And in part, that's because most smokers then and now did not want to be smokers. And so I am just curious if the vaping backlash are by people who are vaping, or if it's more orchestrated. I mean, I have no idea. Or if it's a different segment of the industry. Maybe it's people who own, you know, small vaping shops. But I think one thing that is not yet clear to me, and I guess will just play out over time, is the extent to which there is an authentic vapers community.
So much more to talk about. The book is called The Cigarette, A Political History, published by Harvard University Press. The author is Sarah Mylove. Thanks so much for coming on.
It's an absolute delight. Thank you.
Thank you. My thanks to Sarah Mylove of the University of Virginia for joining us for this interview. You can find out more about her book, The Cigarette, A Political History, at the Harvard University Press website at hup.harvard.edu. The hardest working engineer in show business, the czar of our Tallahassee office, as well as the captain of the GHS unicycle hockey team, is our very own Brendan Cannonball Crellin. Our GHS director of media manipulation is Patty, your newspaper is dead to me, Maher. The GHS playground director, staff archaeologist, and fearless food taster is Elise, the real GSU Butler. Our GHS coordinator of classroom indoctrination is Lisa War Eagle Landers. The GHS maven of social media and library science is Sabrina Human Search Engine Saturday. Our GHS efficiency expert and controller of German names is Karen Bodenschatz-Zollner. The director of the GHS Russian Literature Division is Christy Maple Crisp, assisted by our writing intern, Warren Pease. Our off-the-beaten-path fact-checker is Ella Fino. Our staff groundskeeper is Mo DeLon. The Off the Eaten Path journalism news intern is Phil Madeleven. Our French dog walking intern is Poupon de Grasse. And our staff marine biologist is Frida Wales. If you have an iPhone, you can find our podcast at the App Store or on the podcast app on your phone and, of course, on Spotify. If you have an Android, look for us at Google Play. You can find out everything about the Georgia Historical Society at georgiahistory.com and about the upcoming Georgia History Festival at georgiahistoryfestival.org. Be sure and like Off the Deaton Path on Facebook and Instagram as well. Please also visit deatonpath.georgiahistory.com and check out all of our dispatches from Off the Deaton Path, of course, my blog, and similarly, Surgeon General approved podcasts like this one. Stay safe, stay strong. I'm Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society. As always, thank you for listening.